champion becomes a legend. Mackay Deaver has won it.
Perkins goes in first. What a legend. What a champion.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Such an enjoyable time every week as we sit down with the great of Australian sport, and we do it again on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. My guest today is a man who instilled fear into some of the best batsmen in the world in recent times. He is one of the fastest bowlers ever to pick up a cricket ball. His name is Sean Tate, and he joins us now. Sean, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
How's the body, first of all, because of that incredible action that you had? And we know that fast bowlers, it's a strain on the body at the best of times. But when you're bowling at 100 miles an hour, it's got to be a strain. How are you feeling now, a couple of years after retirement?
I'm pretty good now. No more painkillers, no more running in and whipping it down. So my body actually feels good now. I suppose as good as it can be. You still get a few, obviously every sportsman or anyone really, that over time you get a few cracks and creaks. But to be honest, it's pretty good. I've got no complaints.
Was it always the same action when you were coming up as a youngster? Did you have that same action? If so, did anyone say, gee, this is going to cause a few issues with your body later in life? Did anyone try and tinker with it and just fine-tune it a little bit?
Oh, they did, yeah, absolutely. But when I was younger, playing sort of cricket up in the Adelaide Hills, I had a fairly decent action. I was sort of a bit more upright and sort of just looking to bowl out swingers. Decent pace, I suppose, for a kid. And then I got a bit stronger and something just hit me. I just wanted to bowl fast. And rather than just, I sort of got bored, I suppose, with bowling little outswingers and on the spot type thing. I just wanted to be quick. And I was big enough for it and strong enough for it. And I sort of had the action that could change a bit to become a bit of a slingy type thing, I suppose. And then coming through the ranks at the Sacker as a young fella, some guys tried to tinker with it. Obviously, I had Dennis Lilly used to come around in those times working for Cricket Australia. And spent a lot of time with him, and he was really good, but he could definitely see that I needed to change a few things. I suppose I was a little bit stubborn, though, so
when, didn't change too much. When Dennis Lilly did speak to you, maybe in the back of his mind, he had an old bowling partner of his, because the great Jeff Thompson, of course, had a very much a slinging type of action. Mm. Were you inspired by the likes of Tomo? Was there anyone that did inspire you to give it more of the slinging action after being upright early on?
Yeah, I never saw Tomo bowl. I was too young for that. So it wasn't really Tomo. It was more, I mean, I when I was growing up, it was, McGrath and even to a certain extent, Brett Lee, and I ended up playing with these guys, but to a certain extent, Binger and Shoaib Akhtar. Wasim Akram, Curtly Ambrose, these sort of guys, Waqar Yunus, they're the guys I used to watch. From memory that I liked. And I suppose as I was getting sort of older, teenage years, yeah, Shoaib and Brett, I suppose I got a fair bit of inspiration out of watching their stuff.
So where did the extra speed come from? I'm sure that you've broken it down and you've looked physiologically at how you gained that extra speed. How quick were you bowling when you had the upright action? What was your quick one there?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there was times when I was playing professional cricket, I sort of did get a bit more upright and got a bit more bounce and swing, and I probably should have stuck to that, because eventually you can probably get some pace into that sort of action. So, but obviously there comes a time, if you're playing a four-day game at Adelaide Oval on a pretty flat wicket and you come into the last session, your body's tired. I think that's where it came from. The fact that when I got tired, I tried harder to bowl quicker, and then your action sort of goes a bit all over the place. And I suppose that's where it came from. Looking back, the times that I was fresh, I probably was a bit more upright trying to swing it. And then later in the day, that's when I really got that sling on and sort of bowled reverse swing, because I was tired. So, but I believe it's a lot of it's adrenaline. Even when I played footy as a kid, I'd get fired up quite easily. So I had the adrenaline used to pump. And I just sort of mentally tell myself at training, I've got to bowl fast all the time. I reckon that's got a lot to do with it as well. And speaking of young blokes now about bowling quick, you've got to tell yourself you're a fast bowler, and you've got to push your body to the limits in the nets, because then your body gets used to it. Yeah.
One of the things about the slinging action, Sean, is that I've often heard people who know the bowling action a whole lot better than me, but they talk about the release point and how difficult it is to read it when it's coming almost sideways rather from the top where batsmen are used to seeing it. Did that work in your favour? Do you think that it came from a different release point?
a lot of guys said that it did work in my favour. You know, guys I played against, and then obviously played in the Australian side with them, and we'd talk, just talk, you know, having a beer or whatever it is. And they used to talk about the fact that they didn't really know where it was coming from with me. It sort of came from behind, and it was a bit of a sling, and my arm was sort of not in front of the umpire, like a malinga, but you know, that sort of stuff. So they found it hard to pick me up. That's the feedback I got. Yeah.
When you said before you just like to bowl fast, does it then become a competition to see how fast you bowl, and sometimes that is at the expense of other things that you should be thinking of while you're bowling? Did it ever get to that?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I suppose that's why, if you follow cricket, I bowled a fair few wides, no balls, and this sort of thing. I always had problems with that, and I had problems. Yeah, there'd be games where I'd get tapped all over the park, and I'd cop a fair bit of criticism for that. But then I suppose, you know, talking to coaches through my career, they were like, you're the bowler we want because you can win a game by yourself, but then you can also lose it by yourself. And I suppose I came to peace with that after a while. And I mean, when I'd lose a game, if I bowled a wide in the last over and then go hit for a six or no ball, then I was so down on myself. I was a harder critic on myself than anybody. I was the sort of guy that would apologise to the teammates. I was that down. I just wanted to do well all the time. So... but yeah, I came to peace with the fact that people would want me in their side because I can win a game. But on the other hand, it can go pear-shaped as well.
What about the intimidation factor? When you bowl that fast, when you get it up to 160 kilometres an hour, you are well aware that you have somebody at the other end who either can't see it or is scared of seeing it. How much
doesn't want to see it?
Doesn't want to see it. How much did that play on your mind when you're bowling fast and really fast? How much did you were you aware of the fact that you had someone at the other end who just didn't want to be there?
Yeah, I mean, I reckon that's a huge part of fast bowling. Even if you're bowling 135, you've got to have presence, if that makes sense. You've got to have a presence about you. You've got to try and make yourself bigger in your follow through. You have to carry on the sledge all the time. I mean, I used to say a few things here and there, but it was just silly fast bowler talk. It was nothing personal or anything, but you've got to make sure that they know that you don't like them being there. I think that's a huge thing in fast bowling, and I used to try and do that. I mean, a lot of the time, my job, I felt, was to intimidate the opposition batsman. It didn't always work at all. But if you've got a guy on your team that can bowl 145, 150, and also be in their face and is a scary-looking fast bowler, I reckon it's a huge advantage for your team.
So that intimidation is part of your weaponry, and you have to use that. Did what happened with Philip Hughes change your outlook on the way you bowled?
I suppose I was coming towards the end of my career then. Most of my firebrand stuff was in my first 10 years. I think I played 15 years. So my last five was a little bit more subdued. I was playing 20-20, so obviously one bouncer and over. And you can bowl as fast as you want in T20s. You're probably going to go the journey more often than not. So my game did change a little bit. I wouldn't say my... But that changed anyway before Phil's death. But I suppose it was more the attitude towards cricket. Just don't take it so seriously. If you've hit someone in the head or you've hit them in the arm, don't carry on. Go and see if they're okay. It's all right to do that type of thing. Whereas in the past, when I'd hit guys, I'd just turn around and walk back to my mark. And to be honest, I was fairly happy that I hit them, which that changed when Phil died. After that, I was like, right, this is a game and it's dangerous. So... yeah, that's what changed, probably the mindset.
Was there ever a moment with you, Sean, where you were worried that you'd hit someone and cause some damage?
Yeah. There was times you hit a guy on the helmet. And often enough, to be fair, I did go up and see if they're okay. And a lot of guys, towards the end, because you're playing so much T20 cricket around the place, you end up hitting blokes you know that you've had a beer with in the past or you've played on the same team as. So I remember hitting Michael Lum at Adelaide Oval, hard in the Big Bash. And, yeah, I was worried. I was concerned about him because he's a mate of mine. I hit Luke Wright at the MCG towards the end of my career, hit him hard in the helmet as well. And I'd also played and had a couple of beers with him in the past. So then I started to worry, definitely.
It must be a difficult balancing act, though, because here's one thing that is your absolute weapon, and you need to use not only the cricket ball, but you need to use the psychology of bowling so fast, and yet you're concerned about causing damage at the other end. It's a bit of a battle that goes on, I guess, in your mind.
My whole point about the causing... when I say, I wanted to hit guys and I was okay with it, that was also to get a wicket. Because I knew if I'd hit someone hard, or if, whether it was the arm or the hip or the helmet, I was every chance there was a wicket coming up. And that's the way it used to work, whether it was club cricket or first-class cricket or whatever. I sort of knew that a wicket was coming because you've hit someone and they don't really want to be there, and there's every chance they're going to sort of snick the next one or get out at some stage. So it was all about getting wickets, really. So, yeah.
We'll talk about some famous wickets that you got when you played your first test match a little bit later in the program. What's your involvement with cricket these days after retiring from forms of the game a couple of years ago?
When I first retired, I wanted to get away from it, and I sort of spent 6 months, I suppose, just chilling out. My daughter was born at that time as well. So I spent time with my family, and I didn't really – I sort of wanted to see – the life away from cricket, and that lasted about 6 months. I got jack of it, and I wanted to get back into the game. So it's funny how that works, and yeah, that's all you know, sort of thing. But so nowadays, I'm head coach at Adelaide Career Club. So I've just been appointed that this off season. So that's good. Being a head coach in the grade comp here in Adelaide is going to be a big challenge for me. See how I go. I was playing cricket still in the Adelaide Hills actually until this year as well. As a batsman, believe it or not, mostly on hard wickets, and then just some media. I mean, I've been in India a lot. I've been in Dubai doing coverage for their Premier Leagues over there. So I've done a fair bit of studio analysis stuff in the subcontinent, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. Even a bit of radio with SEN here for the Big Bash as well.
Yeah,
so that's about it. That's the crux of it. So that's still being involved in the game is. It's made me happier than I thought it was going to, put it that way.
Yeah. So what do you think, if we're talking in 5 years or 10 years' time, Sean, do you think I'll be talking to Sean Tate, the cricket commentator and analyst, or do you think I'll be talking to Sean Tate, the Australian coach?
Oh, Australian coach. I reckon if you could say that if I was a bowling coach for a professional side, wherever that might be in the world, I'd be pretty happy with that, to be honest.
All right. And yeah. You spoke about the Adelaide Hills, and that's where you're living these days?
Yeah, not too far from the city of Adelaide, but up in the hills, freezing cold this time of year, but it's a nice place to live. It's like a villagey type feel, and for my wife and daughter, we enjoy it, and the dogs, so yeah, life's good here.
And you were talking about playing footy as a younger man. Where did you play? What position did you play?
I was centre half forward, full forward, yeah. Just all about the goals. I wasn't much for chasing Guernsey. I played a game last year. I went back in the hills. I played for my old club and played a game in the B grade. And I managed to kick a goal, but I did probably lose the game for us. I hit the post in the last quarter and we lost by about a goal. So I think I probably lost the game for us there.
How did the body pull up after that?
Mate, I was about to say, I felt like I'd been in a car accident. Honestly, I was that sore for the next week. I haven't gone back to footy. That'll do me, I think.
I was just talking before we came on air. I was catching up with the Brownlow medalist Adam Cooney out in the production office, and he's come back and played a bit this year. He did his hamstring, and one of the boys said, "Well, why didn't you just play out of the goal square?" And he said, "That's where I was playing, out of the goal square." He said, "If I had been any further back, I would have been standing on the goal umpire's toes."
So he's gone back and played. That's all right. That's good.
And he's questioning why too.
I can imagine. Because when you've taken a few years, I think it's been 3 years since I've retired. Yeah, you sort of body. I mean, to get up, like you talk about fast bowling, to get up and bowl fast, it takes a good 3 months, I think, to get yourself back to that stage. So to have 3 years off and then try and do something like that, it's just your body just shocks your body. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that your action was more suited to the shorter forms of the game? You did play test cricket, and we'll talk about that as the program progresses. But do you think ideally that it was more suited towards ODIs and T20s?
When I was younger, I used to love the one-day cricket. I mean, I obviously watched test cricket, but I remember certain things about test cricket watching as a kid. But all I think about in my childhood watching was the coloured clothing and the one-day cricket. I've always loved it. And obviously, when I first started playing, for South Australia, it was all 4-day cricket. Eventually, I moved into 1-day cricket. My first contract with Cricket Australia was based on the longer forms. I wasn't ranked as a short form player at all, and I found that amazing because I thought I was a better short form player even at that age. I think really sort of deep down, in my thoughts, I was always going to be a short form player. I managed to get through, 40 Shield games, I suppose, and obviously only played 3 Test matches. I look back on now, it would have been lovely to play a lot more of that, certainly. But I think I'm probably built for one day cricket more so, yeah.
All right, we're going to explore that when we come back on the other side of the break, where it all began and when the first realisation came to you that you might be good enough to represent your country, which you did throughout one day internationals and also through those Test matches and that famous Test that we are going to discuss where you took 3 pretty handy scalps. That's all still ahead of us with Sean Tate. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hope you're enjoying the chat with Sean Tate. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Before we get into the start of your cricket career, Sean, who was the first one to generate the name The Wild Thing about you?
I think it was Andrew Simons. He was a good friend of mine when I was playing with the Australian side, and it sort of started that 2007 World Cup. It started around then. They actually put a video, one of the analyst bloke or whatever, and a few of the players got this video organised for the team in a team meeting, and they put it up on a screen, and they played that song and just showed me bowling a heap of wides. And wides that were going for 4 and all this sort of stuff. And I had to sit there and cop that. And the players loved it. And I think probably after that, I can't remember if they were calling me The Wild Thing before that. It all started as a bit of a joke. You know, like the Major League, Charlie Sheen's character, I think it was Ricky Vaughan or something, his name. I think he sort of came out and bowled and threw fast, but threw all over the place. And that's where it came from. And it sort of stuck. I wasn't a huge fan of it, but you don't get to choose your nickname, do you?
So you knew that other people were going to do it, and you knew that because it was a bit funky and it had a good feel to it, it was going to stick. Did it really grate with you, or did you think, oh, well, it's just going to happen, so I may as well just go with the flow?
I just went with the flow. I was pretty young, and these blokes, they were having a laugh, and it was all good. So the only thing was, when they used to play the song at Adelaide Oval, all the players had a song for themselves, and no matter what song I chose to walk out to, they'd play that. So I just thought, I hope everyone here doesn't think that that's the song I've chosen. That they've done it for me. I didn't choose to have that as a song. So, but anyway, it's a bit of fun, isn't it? And I just sort of, it never really went anywhere, I suppose, in the end. I never did any marketing around it type thing. So, but it was a bit of fun.
Now, question without notice, with those songs that have now become prevalent with players walking out to bat or to bowl or whatever, is there one that comes to mind that seems very unusual? Is there one particular bloke that you heard the song and you thought, why have they chosen that?
I remember Ross Taylor. I just remember this. I don't remember too many of the songs that guys walked out to. There were some bad ones, obviously. You're trying to be fired up to walk out and bowl or bat, and you got some, not a love song, but yeah, some rap song or something. I found that strange. Ross Taylor used to walk out to a song called Smack That.
Right.
So he'd walk out to bat, and then I think it was Akon, one of the rappers, sung this song, Smack That. And that was his song to walk out to bat. So put yourself under a bit of pressure if you're walking out to that.
We're only just starting to see the IPL back on television again. It went through this hiatus where, when it first came out, it was the biggest thing in the sport. And then all of a sudden it just drifted away and we didn't get coverage of it. From someone who's never been there, and I'm sure that's most of us, how manic is the enthusiasm and the dedication of the Indian people towards the IPL? It must be just something to behold.
Yeah, I've obviously spent a lot of, my wife's Indian. I've spent a lot of time in India. During the IPL, I played, I don't know how many years, I played 4 or 5 years, and then I managed to go back again a couple of years later just as a squad member. I didn't get a game. And then the last 3 seasons, I've actually done the commentary stuff with the IPL. So I've been heavily involved there. It's got a great feeling about it. It has, I wouldn't say the whole country stops, but you've got a game on every single night and it goes for 2 months and every single game is absolutely packed no matter what. And I suppose a Big Bash is similar, but it's a way of life there in some ways. You just feel it when you're in the cities. Even if the cricket's not on, you can just feel that it's on.
Let's go back, Sean, to that time we were talking about where you're just starting to get your formative steps and obviously you're coming under the attention of some talent people at Cricket Australia. Who was the first one, you think, at the top level who saw in you enough to indicate that you had what it takes to play for your country?
There was a guy called Peter Muggleton here in at the Sacker, and a couple of guys in the coaching here that they first showed the interest in me, and obviously that's from a South Australian point of view. I think they saw it in me, the Sacker saw it in me. I don't think they were surprised when I got called up fairly young age and into the squad. So I think the Sacker in general that time were good for me. And a lot of guys had involvement for that. I'm trying to think to the next level. I mean, John Buchanan was coach, but he had a lot to worry about. He didn't need to worry about a 20, 21-year-old firebrand, to be honest. I wasn't really playing. I was in the squad. But I always come back to – I think it's my teammates. I think if you talk – I never had an actual mentor, I suppose, off the field or anything like that. But I think my teammates – so I look at Jason Gillespie, Darren Lehman. They were two South Aussies. You know, Bluey had probably finished – Greg Bluey had probably finished that time, but – he was in the South Australian squad. So had three guys that have played a lot for Australia around the South Australian stuff. So that was good to have. And I was on tour with Dizzy and Buff, my first tour. And then there was guys, you know, through the next couple of years when I was sort of just about to play my first test match. Shane Warne showed a lot in me as well. He was very keen for me to get a game. He made it really obvious that he wanted me to play as well in the nets and stuff. He would encourage. So I remember at the time him backing me in a lot. And I suppose I bowled to Steve Waugh in a game. I think it was my second or third one-day game. I bowled to Steve Waugh and bowled quite quick and bowled well. And I remember the next year or so in the media, a lot Steve Waugh saying that I should be in the Australian team. So probably got Steve Waugh to thank as well. So, yeah, not just one person. I think just a collective group of people, and I'm probably missing a few as well. But, yeah.
Well, let's go back to the test first, and then we'll talk about that night at the SCG, the day night. Your first test, 2005, famous series. I always remember 2005, Sean, because it was the first time that I got a big screen TV. And I could not wait for that first test. And the first over of that first test of 2005, it was just fantastic Ashes test cricket. To be a part of the team there and a part of the squad must have been just enormous.
Yeah. Oh, it was fantastic. And it's... yeah, listen, there's no time, you know, sometimes you look at it from afar or you're watching it on, you go, that must be fantastic to be a part of that. And sometimes you expect some guys might go, it wasn't that great, but it was. It was brilliant. It was just the hype around in the UK, on the bus with the team, just driving everywhere around the UK, and there's crowds following us, obviously abuse majority of the time. But I didn't play until the fourth test. So just all the lead up to that as well. I enjoyed every single minute just being around those legends in our team, training with them, having a beer with them after wins and whatnot. So I think, to be honest, apart from the actual cricket, I just enjoyed the actual experience itself of just being on that tour with the team, not the actual games, so to speak, but just the other stuff that went on. I just thought it was fantastic, yeah.
What about in that fourth test? They throw you the ball and they say, righto, young fella, it's your turn to bowl in test cricket. What was the nervous energy like inside you?
Oh, yeah, I felt like I was... I mean, I look back now and say maybe I wasn't ready for it, but I felt at the time I was, I think. You know, I was certainly confident enough to play. I'd been bowling really well in the nets. I bowled well in the tour games leading in. Yeah, but it was obviously, it was a fairly flat wicket from memory. I probably tried to bowl a little bit too fast, and then I was very nervous. So, I thought I bowled all right in the first innings. I think I took three for.
Yeah, and three for 97, and the scalps were Triscothic, Ian Bell, and Andrew Flintoff. That's pretty handy trio.
Yeah, Freddie got 100, I reckon. I got him LBW on 100. I mean, that... That first week at Triscothic, I sort of carried on a lot. But that was just my body, my feelings took over. It wasn't a celebration I'd planned or anything like that. I just sort of, it was pure happiness and relief. And I think your whole life you work to something, and that felt like that's what it was, I suppose. It was getting a wicket in test cricket, knowing that you're good enough to knock over someone like a Triscothic. And I just was so happy. My body just took over and I ran and, I think, tackled Gilly. So, amazing feeling.
Yeah. You were talking about the fact, Sean, that you'd been bowling well in the nets. I'm sure Justin Langer would probably attest to that. There was just a little confrontation that happened between you two and the nets in that series. What happened?
It's a funny one, actually, because this is from my memory. That morning, I was having breakfast down at the hotel, Brett Lee came up to me, or someone came up to me anyway, and put the paper in front of me, and it was an article of, that JL was writing for the paper over there. And he basically said that I wasn't ready to play, because I think there must have been some talk they were going to pick me in. That I wasn't ready to play, not good enough, they should play this person, that person, blah, 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 that sort of thing. And from a teammate itself, even though I was so young, and I honestly didn't really care that much, but from a team, now I think about it, from a teammate to write that about a player in your squad that you're training with and you've got to sit on a bus with, I find that amazing. But anyway, at the time, I didn't actually really care. And whoever put the paper in front of me, I think it was Binger, he just said, use that as motivation. And I was like, okay. And I sort of didn't really hit me. But then I got in the nets. And I don't think it mattered who I was going to bowl to that day. Had Trevor Holmes was at the back, sort of behind the bowlers, watching chairman selectors. And I knew that this was going to be the, if I performed in the here in the nets, I'm probably half chance of getting the game, which is what it was like back then. You know, the nets were pretty important. And I just let loose. And I, to be fair, I bowled a full toss that hit him. I bowled a couple of short balls that hit him. And I wasn't into him or talking to him or fired up or anything. He was doing that back to me. He was sort of like, you know, you little smart ass, go back and bowl, you know, blah, 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 all this sort of stuff. And I'd split his box. So I'd hit him, I'd cracked his protector and split that. So it was fairly nasty stuff. But then at the end of it, he came up and gave me a hug and it was all good. Because, he had a good old go at me and I did feel a bit funny. But anyway, I got picked, so it doesn't matter. Yeah.
It's an incident that is spoken about a lot. And obviously from the outside, we look at it and say, well, it must have been a pretty tense sort of situation. But from what you've said, it was only tense for a matter of minutes. It didn't have ongoing consequences.
No. And then I think a couple of days later, I picked up the paper and he wrote an article, which I kept. I cut it out and kept. I think my dad's got it somewhere. Sean Tate, what a great young man. honestly, I wish I had him in front of me now. The two articles, how different they were. What a great young man. No earrings, no tattoos, no bleach blonde hair, blah, blah, blah. Great, you know, this, and I was just like, this is fantastic. I cut it out and gave it to my old man, yeah.
Did you ever subsequently ask Justin why he would do something like that? As you said about a teammate, that it's very unusual to do that.
It is, but as a young bloke, I was 22 in a team full of guys like him and Shane Warne, and the list goes on. McGrath, the superstars, Dizzy, and I just shut my mouth. I wasn't there to talk up in meetings. I wasn't there to talk up when I shouldn't have. I just shut my mouth. I enjoyed every. I actually got along with JL pretty well, so it was no big deal. And I suppose at that time, some of these guys we had. I mean, some of the influence they had on the communities or wherever they went. You know, Shane Warne, for example. They're a big deal, these blokes, all around the world. So to me, it was like, yeah, there's no way I'm going to confront any of these guys. These guys are superstars, so yeah.
You mentioned you played three test matches. One of them was on home soil, and it was on the Wacker wicket. Were you licking your chops when you played a test match at the bouncy Wacker?
Well, it didn't end up being that bouncy from memory. That was another... My test career was a stinker, really. That was another one. I had a shock at the Oval after that first one, really. I didn't bowl much. And the Wacker one, I had... What was going on then? That was... I think I was played as a fourth fast bowler. I probably wasn't going to bowl that much that test anyway. I remember doing a boxing session 2 days out from that game. My skin folds were sort of up, and then I needed to lose a bit of weight apparently and all this sort of stuff. And so I'd been doing extra sessions, boxing sessions, and I twinged my hamstring. So I sort of kept it really quiet from the physio, and I shouldn't have. In hindsight, I shouldn't have played that game, really. So I was worried about my hamstring. I knew that I could bowl fast for about five overs, and after that I'd probably deteriorate. And that was the case. And then mentally as well, it all just hit me. So I just wasn't in a good place mentally or physically at that time. But it is what it is. I didn't take a wicket. I don't think I bowled much. I remember sitting down and finally just not wanting to be there. So that's not, if you're playing a test match and you absolutely don't want to be there, then that's a problem. So I think not long after that, mate, I stepped away and didn't play for a couple of months. So, yeah.
Yeah, from the outside looking in, we think that it's a glamorous life. Here you are on the international stage. You're getting paid good money to do something that you love. But as we're seeing in sport these days, and probably are a bit more aware of it, the pressures that go on, because after all, you are normal human beings and you go home and you have feelings, and that can be a terribly difficult thing sitting on your shoulders sometimes.
Yeah, it's hard to remember. I get asked about it a bit, but it's hard to. I wish I could remember exactly how I was feeling, but it was, what, 2008, was it? Yeah. So it is tough to talk about. Not tough to talk about. It's tough to work out what I was actually going through. I wish I knew more or could remember more, maybe help out some young blokes now. But from memory, I was just fed up. I was fed up with the game. I was fed up with the attention that it brought. I was fed up with my body. I was fed up of Cricket Australia. I mean, and they have to put you under pressure. They have to. You've got to be a certain way. You've got to be fit. You've got to do all that stuff. But I was fed up with it. That's just the way I was. And call it whatever it was. And at that time, I suppose I was called soft and everything under the, you know, you can imagine by all sorts of people, even from the UK, from Australia, and from if I went to the pub, blokes would have a go at me. It was just nonstop. So, yeah, I think I just needed to get away from it all, to be honest. And I sort of went away on a couple of holidays. And I think after a couple of months, I was like, right, you do realize, you're like, well, there's nothing else I'm going to, you know, I do enjoy it. I've just got to get my headspace right and get all the rubbish out of my head and just play the game. And that's what I ended up doing when I came back. I simplified things. I think I don't know if I played another 4-day game, maybe played a couple, but certainly wasn't planning on playing any more longer form cricket. I just want to enjoy myself. Yeah.
We'll talk about the shorter forms of the game, the ODIs, and in particular the World Cup, because we are celebrating the World Cup, and we'll talk about your great success in World Cup cricket when we come back on the other side of the break. Sean Tate is my guest. Hope you're enjoying our celebration of the World Cup. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Good to have you with us for our chat with Sean Tate, the wild thing. I shouldn't have called him that because he doesn't like it. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Sean, you talked about your ODI debut against India in Sydney 2007. We're watching the 50-over game at the moment, but back then, and even before then, the 50-over game was big business, and the atmosphere at those games was off the charts.
Yeah, I think it was against the Poms, actually. But anyway, doesn't matter. SCG against England, I think it was. And I love the fact the build-up to the games back then in one-day cricket. And I suppose it was, well, it was definitely before 2020 was a big hit in Australia. I just loved all the entertainment, SCG, the colour, the crowd building in, the music that was played before the game. It was a little bit more laid back, I suppose, than Test cricket as well. So I just felt like it suited me. I loved every minute of that getting that one day debut. I didn't love it at the end of the game. I was shattered at the end because I think I went for 68 off 10, which is a lot back then. So I wasn't happy with my performance. But anyway.
Did that atmosphere, do you think, help you to bowl fast? Because you get caught up. It's easy to get caught up in a vibe like that where the music is loud and the vibe is loud. Did it help you bowl quickly?
Yeah definitely. I think, look, I know after playing all that time for Australia or whatever and playing 2020 cricket, if I'd gone, when I had to go back and just say you play, like I'd go back to the Sacker, for example, and play an internal trial game at Park 25 with no one around, I used to find it hard to get up for those games. So that was another thing. You know, I got to a point where when I stopped playing 4-day cricket, I didn't miss it at all because I was like, well, you're playing in front of 10 people, whereas T20 cricket, you're always playing in front of a big crowd. And I loved it. And I couldn't, I found it very difficult to go back to playing in front of not many people.
So the adrenaline kicks in when you're playing ODIs, and it kicked in to the extent where you bowl the ball against England in an ODI at 161.1.
Mm.
Did it feel like that when it came out?
Yeah, it did. Well, I don't know if it felt exactly that pace, but it certainly felt quick that day. And it's a funny, cricket's such a funny and fast bowling. Like I was over there playing for Glamorgan. And then I got the call up. Someone got injured. I got the call up to the squad while I was there. So I just jumped on them. And they were playing in Cardiff that night. And I was there having a couple of beers at the game because I was playing locally. And I went in the dressing room after, and I had a couple of beers in the dressing room. And Murph Hughes was there. The selector, he goes, don't have too many tonight because you might be on the bus with us tomorrow. I was like, okay, righto. Then I think I got a phone call saying, you are. So I was like, righto, better wrap this up and jump on the bus the next day in Cardiff where I was living anyway at the time. So and I sort of bowled well for those first two games. We played a game at Manchester. I think we played a game at the Oval. And the last game of the series was at Lord's. And that game, I felt terrible. Like I my body felt tight, and I just thought, this is not right. I'm going to be no good today. And that was the day I went out and bowled Lightning and felt really good when I was bowling and bowled 161. So it's funny how the game works. You don't feel that good leading in, and you end up bowling the fastest ball you've ever bowled. So yeah.
And I think the second fastest ball ever measured. I think Shoaib Akhtar's got you covered by 0.2 of a kilometre an hour.
Yes.
Are you dirty on the fact that he's got you by 0.2?
Oh, it'd be nice to bowl the quickest ball, Tom, but I don't think it would have mattered either way. I mean, Shoaib was a different level. But he sort of bowled up around that pace quite consistently, I think, Shoaib. So he was a different level, yeah. You ask Jeff Thompson, though, and he honestly thinks he bowled 170. So who knows with this speed gun stuff. You know, back then maybe he was bowling that pace, and from all reports he was the quickest of all time. So yes, I don't know if people pay too much attention to it, I suppose. But anyway.
Can you remember who the 161.1 was at the other end when you bowled?
Yes, it was Craig Keyswood at the other end. And
did he see
it? I've seen that footage a few times since, and you talk about guys feeling uncomfortable. You could just see how uncomfortable he was facing it, yeah.
Did he get a bat on it, or was it outside off, or where was it?
Did he hit him in the thigh pad or the glove? Geez. And it went up to sort of square leg type area. Yeah, nothing. It was nothing glamorous, but I bowled a quick spell that day. It was Andrew Strauss and some guys that knocked over at the top. It was just a great atmosphere. It was a very... probably the most memorable match I've ever played in. I think I took 4 wickets and got the man of the match, and we beat England as well. So it was one game I'd certainly love to go back and play again.
I reckon if you hit him on the thigh pad at 161.1, the bruise would have subsided about 2 days ago.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. He wasn't happy to be there, I know that much. So, yeah. And I think after that series, there was calls for me to come back and play on the test side, but it never happened, yeah.
Let's go to the World Cup 2007. As we said, what are your memories of that great time for Australian cricket?
Well, yeah, I'll put that up there again. So, that Ashes series, a game like the one we just spoke about, 161, getting your bag of green, that stuff. I think if there was one part of my career, if I had to leave one part of my career there, it'd be that 2007 World Cup. That's something that I would never take away. It was... Again, off the field was fantastic. Good fun to be around the guys. It was laid back because it was in the Caribbean, and everything just clicked right on the field. It was one of those rare moments when you just know you're not going to lose. And a great environment to play in, off the field and on the field. So it all just came together perfectly.
What about 4 years later? It was a vastly different experience. There seemed to be a few little things going on behind the scenes, and some of them came to light as well, and they were there for all to see. Was it an uncomfortable atmosphere amongst the team in 2011 because of some of those things?
I'm trying to remember what was going on.
Well, it was I think the Steve Smith, Ricky Ponting incident after a catch.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's right.
It just seemed there
threw
was
the ball on the ground.
Yeah, there was just a bit of an edge to it.
I've got to say that. Yeah, you're right. So I've got to say the environment was a hell of a lot different in 2007. I can't quite put my finger on it. I can't remember exactly, but it didn't feel like we were going to win the World Cup, to me, if I'm honest. So, things just... nothing bad, but something just wasn't quite right. Something wasn't clicking. And we're probably all to blame for that as well. We had some good times in that trip as well, but it was certainly the complete opposite to 2007.
And I think that turned out to be your final ODI for Australia, the quarterfinal against India.
Well, that's the other thing. If you're happy just to call it quits there and then, I mean, I had other reasons as well, but if you're happy just to walk out of the side and not, then obviously I wasn't having the greatest time of my life. So, I think we played the last game at Ahmedabad against India. They beat us and my last wicket was Sachin, so it could have been worse. Yeah.
Yeah, not a bad one to bow out on.
Yeah.
We'll bow out of this segment and we'll come back with our final segment in just a moment and talk about the game as it stands today. That's all still ahead of us with Sean Tate on the other side of the break. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Our final segment with Sean Tate, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tatey, the T20 game, It was a phenomenon before we even saw it in England, and everybody said, watch this, it's just going to take over. Well, it certainly seems to have taken over. Do you think that the future of Test cricket has been jeopardised at all by the phenomenon that is T20, or does one add to the other?
I think one adds to the other. That's what I think. I don't know the answer. I don't know the exact answer to that. I don't know if it will jeopardise things or anything. Obviously, there's been talk of the one-day game suffering, but I think when you've got a World Cup to look forward to every 4 years, I think the one-day game should stay there. I think they're looking to do more things around that, like make it a more of a common... make games relevant through the year. You know, you go and play a one-day series in India for 7 games and no one cares in Australia. You don't... You know, you've got to make it more relevant. You've got to make... you've got to put more on the games, whether it's a championship that leads into a World Cup or a trophy at the end of every couple of years, or just something that keeps things going. And it's probably the same as Test cricket, that Test championship they talked about, or having two divisions, or whatever it might be, you know, relegation, or I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. Just something to tinker the game to make it more exciting, keep people engaged, especially the overseas trips. Unless you've got Foxtel half the time and you want to stay up late, obviously we can't see a hell of a lot of it, so it is difficult.
We're spoilt with some of the crowds that we have, especially in Ashes series. But you look at some of the Test cricket that goes on around the world, and you could basically count the number of people in the stands. Yep.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You do, everyone. And it's funny because every time there's a game that's really good, so you play, you see a Test go down the wire, which isn't always the case.
Mm.
And you, especially on Twitter and social media, all that stuff, you see guys come out and say, this is why Test cricket is a pinnacle. This is Test cricket, blah, blah, blah. But what they forget is, the 10 games in between that one and the last one that happened, it was pretty ordinary Test cricket. So that's the problem, I think. And I might be wrong, but that's the way I see it. It's all well and good to say Test cricket is great after one really good game, good Test. But then the others in between, there might be a West Indies versus South Africa. There's no one at the ground and the wicket's flat and it's a crap Test. That's the stuff that doesn't get spoken about, which is what the problem is, I suppose. So putting more, again, putting more on the games, putting more on a Test series, rather than just having these two Test series versus Sri Lanka in the middle of some ridiculous time of year that no one cares about, they've got to make it a lot more important, I think. And I don't know what the answer to that is. It's just me just thinking out loud, yeah.
Sean, it's been a pleasure to sit down for an hour and relive your great career. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been enjoyable. Cheers, mate.
Sean Tate joining us. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Hope you can join us next time.